Hi folks, how you doing? Thank you very much indeed for tuning into another episode of my weekly podcast, Soundtracking with Edith Bowman. We're looking ahead to the next few weeks and just trying to work out what we can do, what the conversation should be with regards to the strikes that are going on in the States, and finding ways that we can incorporate or tell the stories that need to be told around that. So we're working behind the scenes on that. And if there is anything that you feel we should be talking about, then please do get in touch using info@edithbowman.com, because I said last week, I think on the show, that we'd really like to try and explain to the world, or to the people who listen to this podcast at least, the importance of the strikes and why they're happening and why they're important. So if you could think of anybody who might be a good spokesperson for that, then please do get in touch, info@edithbowman.com. Now, in a change to our Build interview, which was supposed to be with Ludvig Göransson following Christopher Nolan last week, it is on the way, but we are putting out ahead of time my chat with Catherine Ferguson. And there's a very important reason for that. Catherine directed the Sinead O'Connor documentary, Nothing Compares, which very specifically concentrates on the tumultuous period in her life between 1987 and 1993, during which she became a global sensation, but also the victim of, well, a character assassination in the media, having spoken out against abuse in the Catholic Church. And in the way that life can throw you, you know, curveballs, and in a cruel, cruel twist of fate, Catherine and I spoke just 3 days before the devastating news of Sinead passing. But I've been in touch with Catherine because I wanted to speak to her about what the plans were with the film, but also how she felt about sharing our conversation. And we thought it timely that we shared the story of this beautiful, powerful and illuminating film. Now, I first saw Nothing Compares end of last year, I think. It was on a very short cinematic release, and it kind of just floored me, to be honest. Sinead, as an artist, was someone that she kind of hypnotized me in a way. I just couldn't not watch her whenever she appeared on screen. Her music was kind of peppered throughout as I was discovering music, I guess, as well, and still feels really, really important. So when the opportunity to chat to Catherine came up around the release of the film onto TVs, I jumped at the chance. And so I'm so grateful that we had the opportunity to chat about this. And I think because after our conversation, Sinead and her story were so clear in my head after speaking with Catherine, when the news hit, it was like a sucker punch, to be honest. But I'm really proud that we're able to share this episode with you. And so let's get to the wonderful Catherine, and there's really only one place to begin. It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep. Your love. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. I can eat my dinner in a fancy
How are you doing?
Hey! Really good, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Sorry, I'm a few minutes late.
Oh, don't worry. Thank you for getting up and doing it so early for me, and such quick turnaround as well. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. Thanks for being interested in it. It's really cool.
Where did the journey start for you with regards to, I want to make this film, and how do I make it, and where do I start?
Well, it's quite a story, but basically I was introduced to Sinead when I was very young, through my dad. So he would have played The Lion and the Cobra on repeat as we drove around Belfast, where I'm from, in the rain a lot of the time, with the rain pelting the windows and The Lion and the Cobra just belting out of the car. And it just became this like really visceral soundtrack to my really early childhood. It was just always being played in our family. And then in the early 90s, when I was a very young teenager, my friends and I felt like we discovered her for a second time. And by that point, we could really like see how she looked and appreciate what she was saying. And of course, as well, loved the music passionately. But we're just so proud to have this icon from our own island that we could admire. However, it felt as soon as we kind of found her in the early 90s, was only a year or so before the horrendous backlash took place in 1992, 93. And for me and my friends, it was just a really demoralizing thing to go through as young Irish girls to see this person that we really looked up to just being absolutely annihilated in the press and on this global scale. So that's really where it all started because it made such an impact on me at such an important age. And then I started making films in my 20s in the noughties, and I went back and did a master's at the Royal College of Art in 2011. And when I was there, I made a film called Mather, which is Gaelic for mother, and it was an experimental short that was starting to unpick some of the themes that are in Nothing Compares. And I could think of no one more whose music I desperately wanted to use for this score than Sinead's. And I very cheekily reached out to her managers at the time in 2011 and said, would there be any way that I could get access to the stems to work with a composer to deconstruct them for this experimental short? And it was actually Faulkner O'Kelly, her manager at the time, he agreed and he said, all right, go wild and do what you want.
Amazing.
And I got to do that for this short. And I sent the short to them, not expecting to hear anything back. And I don't know if I did even hear anything back for a year or so. But then they did get back in touch in 2012 and asked me to direct a music video for Sinead for her track Fourth and Vine. And I think that had been her first music video, I think, in 15 years.
Wow.
I know, but
That
no.
must have felt amazing, though, to kind of like, I mean, how did you feel when you got when that ask was presented to you, considering that relationship that you had with personally with her music and her imagery, her storytelling, all of that?
I was ecstatic. Totally ecstatic and terrified and excited and over the flipping moon, to be honest.
I'm gonna put my pink dress on and do my hair up tight. I'm gonna put some eyeliner on. I'm gonna look real nice. I'm going down to the church on Fourth and Vine. I'm gonna marry my love and we'll be happy for all time. Yeah, he's the sweetest man you could find. So gentle and so kind. And he's got those big brown eyes. I can't believe me luck, he's mine. Not that he's no wuss, girls, you know his love is serious.
So I got to then meet her. I got to spend like 3 days with her in Dublin, and then we shot the film in County Meath in Ireland. And I got to meet her, and I got to meet the kind of team around her, including John Reynolds, who's obviously a big part of Nothing Compares. And really, that's where that relationship began. And I kept very much in touch with John over the years about various projects and things. And, we remained close. And, I suppose what the meeting, the meeting in 2012, 2013, what it did for me is it just completely reminded me of like all of these feelings I'd had, these powerful feelings I'd had as a teenager. And to stoke the fires further in me and reminded me of her story and what she meant to me. But the difference being in my 20s, then I had the tool of film, I had this way of expressing what I was feeling and thought, my God, I want to try and tell this story. But that was 2013, and I was really just getting going with my work at that point. So it took another 5 years until I managed to actually meet the film's co-writers and co-producers, Michael Malley and Eleanor Emtage, and I found my team, people
Amazing.
Who were up for it and willing to take it on with me. So that's a convoluted answer to your question.
No, but it's beautiful because it really kind of cements your connection with heart and with, you know, you can feel that. You can feel that drive for truth and authenticity and kind of almost sort of given her a voice, really. Do you know what I mean? That she never really had the opportunity to have in those times to address all that press coverage and just kind of, you know, where it came from as well. And it feels so pertinent to now, you know, in terms of where we are with our media and with the way that it's kind of, you know, it almost kind of has an agenda against people sometimes, you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, I remember kind of not really understanding why everybody was being so mean to her. I remember MTV generation, you know, of kind of when my mom and dad got MTV, and that video is the thing that I remember as being the kind of the visual representation of that time for me, of kind of going, oh my God, I can see music as well as hearing it now through these videos. And she was such a big part of that. When you were thinking about the film then, how much kind of rested on being able to get a sit down chat with her and being able to have her voice now in it, in a kind of reflective mode? And how did you approach her about that? And what was her kind of response?
Sure. Well, I suppose at the very beginning, way back in 2018, when we started it, we thought we could possibly Frankenstein lots of interviews and, you know, prior, just interviews that existed out in the world already, radio interviews, talk shows. We thought we could Frankenstein it, because we just thought maybe we can do this without having to ask anything of her or too much of her. However, as we got going, and of course we could have done that, but we were then through John very happily granted this interview in 2019, and we obviously jumped at the chance. And by that point we had started putting down, you know, we already knew exactly what we wanted to say in the narrative, and what we wanted to ask Sinead. And what we weren't ever planning to do was a biopic, you know, a birth to today story, which would be exhausting to interview somebody for her, would be exhausting to be interviewed about. We just wanted to talk about this era and this time and what the hell happened during those 5 years. So it was a very focused approach to an interview. And yeah, we were granted this interview, and it took place over a long weekend in Dublin at the end of 2019. And really, you know, it is the film, actually. We hadn't quite realised prior to doing it just how important it would be. I mean, just to have her telling her story from this contemporary viewpoint, you know, with all this hindsight on what went on, it was just everything. And I suppose for me, what really became clear when I heard the interview was just, you know, just how potent it was to have this, you know, have her telling her story, you know, in the cinematic format where viewers can't leave, or, you know, hopefully don't get up and leave for 97 minutes, just hearing her tell you what happened to her. This is somebody, as you say, who's had her voice hugely reduced by the media, often mocked. And yeah, just very, very, it's been very reductive treatment of her voice. So to have her voice as this crystal clear bell-like sound that just takes you through this whole 97-minute story was everything. But we didn't even realise how much it would be until we did it.
Because it is that thing where, you know, her childhood is so, it's all joy, it's all linked, it's all kind of part of her story. And we crave our idols to shout and talk about the things that are important. That's why they are idols and heroes, because they've got that platform and they use it in a way that is helping others. And that's what I feel the film really does and celebrates, is the fact that that's all she was trying to do, really, was kind of get a conversation going and talk about things that nobody else had the balls to talk about or address or shine a light on, sort of thing as well. That wasn't really a question, sorry. That was just an observation
But it's so true. And it's just, you know, I suppose in today's world, you know, so many celebrities are very active, which is great. But, you know, you got to remember back in 92, there was nothing cool or sexy about what Sinead O'Connor was talking about. It was a horrendous, brutal truth about abuse of power in the church, one of these powerful institutions. And people just did not know what to do with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was
they wanted to get her back in a box. That was the whole thing, is kind of like,
literally,
you know, quiet. Yeah, basically.
Yeah, and she was a good couple of years before that horrendous scandal broke across the world and the truth all came out about what had been happening in the church. And
yeah,
she was a canary in the coal mine, you know. And she got absolutely pummeled for it.
It's such a weird question, but what was she like to sit down and chat to?
She's just very, you know, amazingly reflective. I thought the interview, she was very astute, and I think we just had a really amazing, you know, authentic interview from her, really. You know, I'm so glad. We only got the one. It was only the one that we had. It was a couple of hours. And yeah, that's all we got. And we didn't go back for more or ask anything more of her. We just wanted to have this one interview so that she could be telling her own story in her own words. And I mean, you know, it was a brief interview, but I think it said everything that we needed it to say.
And then you have all this amazing footage as well, some of which, you know, I've seen, but loads of things that you've unearthed and discovered. Was that must be such a kind of hard work, but a brilliant part of this type of filmmaking, you know, in terms of when you are trying to find the kind of, you know, the historical footage to either back up or contradict what she's saying, you know, to kind of to help tell the story in that kind of visual way. What was that kind of journey like in terms of finding things and unearthing things that you know, that were a beautiful surprise? Or
Totally. Well, the way we put our film together is we actually got our funding through all the national funds. So it was like Screen Ireland, Northern Ireland Screen, the BFI Doc Society and Field Division came in from New York. So we had, the way we funded it was in little clumps, the whole, you know, over like a 3-year period until we could get into the edit properly. So every time we got a little amount of money, we brought in our amazing archive producer, Joe Stones, who would come in and spend maybe a couple of weeks or a month just like deep diving through all of the archives of the world to try and mine for these Sinead gems. And really, by the time we started our edit in 2021, I think really she'd exhausted all of what was officially out there. But when things got really exciting was in 2021, when we started to do our contributor interviews with a lot of the people that appear in the film, like friends and family and people that were actually there at the time. Mm. And we would suddenly be sent on these like wild goose chases, because someone would be like, oh, I've heard there's this guy in America who's got this box of tapes in his cupboard. You've got to reach out to him. I don't have any contacts, but I'm sure I can put you in someone who might. And we went on these like wild journeys to try and uncover these gems. And even I remembered when I was at the Royal College of Art, Dick Joel, the artist, was the tutor of a friend of mine, and I knew that he'd shot loads of footage of the 80s of Lee Bowery's club, Kinky Gerlinky, in the 80s, and we'd worked out that Sinead had played there a few times. And we managed to reach out to Dick. He's like, oh yeah, I've got all of these performances of Sinead playing in this club that have never been seen before. And this was really late. This was like a month before locking the edit. And it's that stunning performance where she comes in the club and sings a Cole Porter song, You Do Something To Me.
Yeah.
just unbelievable uncovering gems like that. But of course, our edit was like nearly locked at that point. Every time we got something in, we're like, Christ, can we like reshuffle the edit to try and squeeze these things in? And every time we were like, yes, we are going to reshuffle because these are just exquisite, never seen before, absolute gems of footage of her. And I particularly love the recording studio, you know, the rehearsal space, 1985, the footage of her in 1985 with hair, you know, rehearsing with the band that she went on to do The Lion and the Cobra with. I mean, it's just unbelievable seeing.
You kind of feel like so privileged to get to see, those moments, like you're kind of like peering through the door almost in a way. It's so brilliant.
And even the wedding footage of 15-year-old Sinead O'Connor saying, well, you don't actually see her because the videographer at that wedding in early 80s didn't actually point the camera at her, but you can hear her singing Evergreen by Barbra Streisand. And it's just... oh, you can just hear the voice. It hasn't changed. You can just hear the voice.
Oh. When it came to the sound of the film as well, you know, you've obviously got those moments of her, the, you know, brilliant performances, and her music is clearly part of, is a character and part of the narrative of the film sort of thing. But when it came to score and working with Irene and Linda, you know, in terms of their work and how they would complement each other, did you know what you needed? How did that work? What was the kind of journey of the score with it?
It was quite a convoluted journey in that Mick Mahon, the film's editor, is amazingly musical as well. He actually used to play in lots of bands at the same time in Dublin as when Sinead was getting going. So knew that world so well. And he was such an integral part to the film in general. But I suppose we started with a temp score at the very beginning of our edit. You know, we started to put bits in, and which is tricky because, of course, then you start to fall in love with temp score, which is always the very tricky thing with making a film. But yeah, he had very nuanced ear, especially for getting the emotional beats just right. So we had a real sense, even at that stage, of where we were going to take it musically. And it had to be, yes, as you say, it had to like absolutely complement and sit in with Sinead's music, which works, you know, every track that features in our film is almost like a biographical beat in itself that takes you into the story. So it was a real dance trying to everything work together. When Linda and Irene came on board, I suppose towards, you know, the last 4 or 5 months of the film, they just did an unbelievably brilliant job then of taking what we had, which was a lot of their music, to be fair. Mick had actually included, I'd say 80% of the temp score was the Buckleys. Right. And then they were going back trying to, you know, I suppose, bring something new to it and reconstruct their own music in ways that made sense to them as composers. So there was just, it was just a constant tweaking and collaboration of just, it's just so much of it was about the emotion, as it always is with scores, but really, you know, so much of our film's about grief and what she went through. So it was just so nuanced and emotionally led, I think. And for me as a director, I knew exactly what I wanted every second of our film to feel like. So it was trying to illustrate that sonically in between her tracks was a real, you know, it was a real creative exploration, but it was amazing. And they're so unbelievably talented, the Buckleys. So it was a joy.
Why were the Buckleys?
Just, I think Mick actually introduced me to the Buckleys. Group of sisters, I mean, they're just amazing, and they're just making this amazing, it just felt like a very contemporary take, I suppose, as composers. I just hadn't really heard anything like it before. Mm-hmm. I loved that they were sisters and they worked together. They were obviously huge Sinead fans, felt, you know, grown up the same time as me, and it felt this exactly the same feelings about Sinead growing up. So there was just a real connection over that, and I really wanted it to be women that scored.
Yeah.
This felt like a really natural progression. So the Buckleys were fabulous.
It's just right on so many levels as well, and I love how, you know, it's her music's her music's so kind of powerful and connects with you. And I love, but an easy option would have been to almost kind of for the score to be almost like an instrumental version of that. And it's so not. And I love that it's kind of deliberately not, but it really has such an emotive kind of, it's almost kind of like, you know, once you hear a song and you realize how you feel about it, or the hairs on your arms are standing on end or whatever. It's almost like the kind of musical equivalent of that.
Well, that's beautiful to hear. Yeah. And actually, so much of, I'm thinking back, because I'm just trying to go back through the mists of my memory, but so much of the Buckleys was actually how they used their voices.
Yeah.
In a similar way to Sinead. Mm-hmm. And the big thing with Sinead's music, I'd say, is this idea of keening. You know, how Irish women traditionally would have keened, cried in a song, and you know, keening was something that would have been done at funerals, a bit like women in the Middle East would do. You know, it's throwing their voices, and that's what we would have done historically in Ireland. And I just have always felt like so much of Sinead's music is a keen, and I think that's why it probably emotionally cuts through and reaches people, because they can emotionally resonate with what they're hearing. Because it's this really authentic sound that's coming out of her, and I think the Buckleys do that too with their voices, actually. But then bring in all of these amazing and quite hard synthy tracks and everything as well. So it's a contemporary take on that. So it just felt like a contemporary response, I think, to Sinead's music. So it just felt very organically that would work.
Yeah, it really works. I remember after seeing the film, being in the car and like putting on Mandinka straight away and kind of just like screaming along. And I felt amazing afterwards. It was like, let it out, let it go. Yeah. It was like, so great. So like good.
She evokes a lot of car sing screams, actually. Yeah. I think a lot of people have said that.
Absolutely. Did she watch the film once? Has she seen it?
She hasn't seen it. Well, not as far as I know. She was offered to see it before it was released, but politely declined. She said she didn't want to have to watch it all again. But she's been amazingly supportive of it. And she's just been a huge support this past year and a half with it. And that just feels bloody brilliant, to be honest. And fair dues to her for not wanting to sit through it again.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't want to sit through my life, thank you very much. But she's very behind it. You know, we had her blessing from the start, and she's just been amazing, really a huge support.
And I don't know, it feels like, you know, she was it this year she had that album out?
No, the newest one's coming out at the start of 2024.
Amazing.
And it's with David Holmes. David Holmes produced it. And on the grapevine, I've not heard it yet, but friends I have heard it have said it's extraordinary.
Oh man, I can't wait. I think that, you know, your film does so many things, Catherine. It's a beautiful and brilliant piece of work. But I think it also just, like I said, I think at the start of that thing of kind of being a kind of, you know, giving her a voice, almost the equivalent of having like a defense lawyer in a court, you know, in a court drama, of kind of going, well, no, you know, it's just, it's so great. And I felt so angry afterwards as well, watching it, in terms of how she was treated and how unfairly she was treated. And I just think you've done a beautiful job of righting so many wrongs through the film. So,
thank you. Yeah, no, well, the anger you feel in it, a lot of it is my anger as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's for all of us. We just have always felt there was a huge injustice done to her, and it's often repeated and repeated with many women. And this was such a crystal clear example of how awful patriarchy is, and, you know, how much they desperately needed to silence her, because here was a 25-year-old woman. I mean, she was so young in 1993, speaking up about things that were so important and needed to be heard. Mm. And she caused that much anger and fury that they had to shut her down. They obviously deemed her somewhat dangerous. she was that famous and that popular and was saying things that people just could not hear, and they shut her down. And I just think when people, yeah, people watch the film now, there's a lot of tears, there's a lot of rage, yeah. But I think what's been so fabulous is that people seem to come out really galvanized and want to transform that anger into some, you know, to positive action. Because yeah. I think when you see she was on the right side of history, everything she said was completely the yeah. truth, and she did everything right. What was done to her was what was wrong. I think it's a big reminder that you just have to use your flipping voice to speak about the power of it,
yeah.
no matter what the consequences are, because it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
And I think it's a big reminder in that. And I'm just so thankful that it's now coming full circle. And, you know, and the most satisfying, honestly, it was so brilliant when the film, it was released on TV in America in September on Showtime.
Yeah.
And when they were doing the promo for that, I was walking in the woods with my 3-year-old, and somebody sent me a photo, and they're like, "Have you seen this?" I was like, "What?" And it was a massive billboard of Sinead's face in Times Square.
Oh.
And of course I didn't flip and know what was happening. And then I was just thinking, oh my God, like the last time her image would even have appeared in Times Square was when they were steamrolling over her albums
yeah.
in 1992.
Oh my God.
After Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
30 years ago, nearly to the week. It was bizarre timing. And then there she was on this massive billboard just staring out.
That's amazing. That's so great.
It was so good. I was like, there she is. The Phoenix from the flames.
You did that. You did that.
Well, she did. But it was just very satisfying. It was like, and there she's back where she should be. So, it's been a real privilege. It was great.
I'm so glad that it's kind of, you know, getting a TV release here as well, so as many people
yes.
as possible can see it. So it's absolutely brilliant. It's what's next? Do you know what's next?
Well, I'm just finishing a film at the minute, actually. I'm working on a new film with a couple of the Nothing Compares team again. It's actually about the golden age of Hollywood and censorship.
Oh, wow.
So it's completely different. It's a commission with Universal. So in the final edit on that
amazing.
The next few months. So that should be out next year. So yeah, something
I'll come
different.
Back and chat about that then when that gets
yes.
released, please. It'd be so
yes.
great to chat to you again. Listen, yes. before you go, I wanted to start to do this thing of trying to get just recommendations from people. And it can be anything, you know, it could be book, music, film, TV, theater, anything. Have you got 3 recommendations that you could throw my way? On anything. I mean, you've probably been like deep in a dark basement edit for the past. So you're, but the last 3 things that have really connected with you, whether it's, you know, a piece of music or anything creative, really.
Yeah, well, okay. There's a book of short stories by one of my favorite female Belfast writers, Wendy Erskine, called Dance Move. That's a really good book of short stories to read, and a really contemporary take on Northern Ireland post-Troubles and the culture that we're living in now. So that's definitely a book to get your hands on. Theatre. I haven't had the chance to go to the theatre in so long, apart from bringing my 3-year-old to Hey Dougie. So I live out.
It's got to be creative for the kids too.
I know. So theatre, I haven't got anything as much as I wish I did. What else was I think? I mean, the film definitely that touched me and I think touched everybody the most this year was After Sun, because I just thought it was exquisitely done
yeah.
and has inspired me no end. And I actually, I'm planning on starting to work on a drama idea myself. So that's
brilliant.
Really inspired me hugely. And yeah, I recommend that more than anything. Crikey, what else? I love Lancome's music. I think another Irish band. But I just think what they're doing at the minute is absolutely exquisite as well.
Perfect. There you go. That's your 3. That's awesome. That's so great. I'm going to go and buy the dance move and read dance
yeah.
move.
Yes, it's brilliant.
I'm about to go on a road trip in Scotland for a week. So I'm like, perfect. Fabulous. Yeah.
Perfect.
Headed over to Isla to get some good old fresh air.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'm planning on doing that in the autumn, actually. We're in Margate. So yeah, we're hoping to do a blast as far as we can of North trip. Isla is exactly where I want to go, actually.
I'll let you know any tips whilst we're up
there.
Of course I will. Yeah, thanks so much. It's so great to chat to you.
I really appreciate
you kind of, you know, coming on at such short notice as well. It's been absolutely brilliant. And I hope to chat to you again soon, Kathy. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Have a great day.
You
thanks,
too.
Lovely.
You
bye. Cheers. See ya. I'm dancing. Line and the Cobra, that's the classic Mandinka by Sinead O'Connor, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Catherine Ferguson. My huge thanks to Catherine for taking the time to talk to us and also for agreeing that we should release this episode of the podcast, considering that we spoke only days before the passing of Sinead. Nothing compares. Her extraordinary film is available to watch on different places around the world, Showtime in the States and here in the UK. I know it's on Sky TV and Now, but if you just seek it out, you will find it, and you will find it incredibly rewarding, because if you're not aware of Sinead's story and you're only aware of it through headlines, please go and watch this film, because it tells her story. It's an incredibly important piece of filmmaking. Catherine also mentioned After Sun there, and you can listen to my chat with writer-director Charlotte Wells by heading to edithbowman.com, where you can also listen to every single other episode of our Wee podcast. As I said at the start, if there's anyone that you think would be a really good spokesperson to come on and talk to us about the strikes and kind of get the story out there, then please do get in touch. We are info@edithbowman.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are @SoundtrackingUK, and please do follow us on our YouTube channel as well. Next up, as promised, we're going to bring you my chat with the wonderful Ludvig Göransson talking about Oppenheimer. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.